back to the studios at Ealing in the 1970s, or the Pit of Cloris, as Doctor Who fans will know it. Paul Jeffries is the sound effects editor. He's also been there since Christopher Eccleston took the helmet regulator of the TARDIS. Nick Briggs is a monster, an absolute monster. Lots of them, actually. He's the Cybermen, he's the Jadoon, he's the Nestine consciousness, but most of all, he's the Daleks, aren't you, Nick?
That's true.
That's not the right voice, is it?
Oh, hold on.
That's true.
Thank you very much. But I'm sure they won't mind if I say that the top of the bill this afternoon is Brian Hodgson, formerly of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, the man who, in 1963, using only a piano, a door key, some magnetic tape, and his own towering genius, created the sound that began our 50-year journey through time and space. Brian, when you hear that sound now, what does it conjure for you?
It's like time travel. I go back half a century, and it is half a century. It was a very strange thing. Warris and Verity Lambert came.
Warris is saying he was the director of the
original
story.
Director. And they said, we want a sound of something traveling through time and space. But we don't want it to sound like a rocket. So where do you go? I mean, where does a time machine move? And the phrase, the rending of the fabric of time and space, I don't know whether I invented that or Verity or Warris, but that's what I was working on. And it took me about a fortnight to really get my head around what I wanted to do. But I didn't want something that went up. I wanted it to go up, and I wanted it to go down, and I wanted it to go sideways. And we had this piano. I wasn't cruel to piano. No pianos were destroyed in the making of this sound. And it was an old Sunday school piano that had gone out of tune, and Desmond bought it for a fiver, and they stripped all the casing off. So we just had the iron frame and this. So I got my mum's front door key and started playing with the piano, drawing the key up and down the bass strings. And once I got those recordings, I started speed changing them and playing them together with each other. I wanted sounds to approach and depart at the same time, so I used a thing called feedback, which was very easy to do on the tape recorders we had in those days. And feedback sort of, if I said hi, with feedback on it, go hi, 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 hi. And if you play that backwards and put feedback on again, you go hi, 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 hi. So it came backwards and forwards. I did that with some oscillator notes, some white noise, put it all together, and we created the TARDIS with a rising note and lots and lots and lots of feedback and delay. The trouble was, once we created it, that was fine, because it took off at the end of the story. But until I got the second script, I realized I hadn't actually done a landing. And so there's great consternation. So we did the good old-fashioned trick. We played it backwards. took the bang off the front, turned it round, put it on, put some more feedback on, and that's what it stayed.
Tim and Paul, when the series was brought back in 2005, you had this kind of archive of sound effects to work with. To what use did you put Brian's work when you were remodelling the sound world of the TARDIS?
Well, we had a meeting with Russell T. Davis, who was the showrunner. We said, Russell, obviously the TARDIS is coming back. What noise do you want it to make? And he said, well, just like it is, you can't change it. He said, that's the sound. It's got to be the TARDIS. And I thought, thank God for that. That'll save us making anything. And but it's Britain's most iconic sound effect. Why would you want to change it? It'd be like, you know, defacing an old master, really. I thought it was just brilliant. It's still fantastic. It's still exactly the same.
I think Paul, but you did give it some strange tweaks, didn't you?
Well, it has been modified a bit as well, but basically these sounds are sacred. They're 50 years old and they're sacred, and you can't play around with them. I mean, I took our piano apart and started at it with a coin up and down the strings. So Russell T. Davis said it's got to be the same, but I had to make the atmosphere track for the interior of the new TARDIS. And so in a homage almost to the original sounds that Brian Hodgson had made, I took the growl sound, I sampled it into my keyboard, and then I played it at the very end of the keyboard, and so it sounded very slow, and it came a breathing type sound.
Shall
effect.
We hear it?
Let's hear it.
Let's
hear
get it.
It
in our ears.
So that's the growl sound sampled, played at the very end of the keyboard, and it makes it breathing, because the TARDIS, for us, when it came back again, it was an animal, it was a beast. And before, I think it had been rather clinical and electronic. It was certainly very white and clean. It was always dirty and manky, and so that breathing sound fitted it well. But also the homage, it was picking up on 50 years ago, and it sounded like it was almost at rest, sleeping, and it really was, because it's the same sound.
Your TARDIS, Brian, from the 60s, was much more futuristic an entity than it is now. It didn't have this retro element to it, did it?
Yes. Well, it was very futuristic then. Nowadays, of course, it's very old-fashioned, but production values change. You know, that was what you expected in the 50s when, you know, space was bloop, bloop, bloop. It isn't like that anymore. We've had Star Wars, we've had all these wonderful films with very high production values. We couldn't go back.
Okay, well, 50 years ago, the first alien world to which the TARDIS took us was a dusty, radioactive place called Skaro, home of the Daleks. Brian formulated the Dalek voices, and Nick Briggs here performs them today. Let's hear the real Daleks from the 60s.
Dalek's master plan, apart from the noise at the end.
This is a test.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because the modulation rate was quite high on that. The frequency was quite... I'm sounding
now
like
you can already
such a nerd
hear
already.
That Nick is a man who's deep into his subject. Now, you came to this armed with all of this knowledge, didn't you?
That's why I got the job, you see, because I'd been doing the voice of the Daleks for the Big Finish full cast audiobooks licensed by the BBC. I've been, you know, directing and writing and what have you, but I also said when we were doing the Daleks, I said, will you let me do the Daleks, or do you want to see a grown man cry? And so we found out, you know, how to do it, basically by learning from stuff that we'd read that Brian had said over the years.
So how is it done, then?
Oh, well, I don't know technically. Brian can tell you that better than me, but I've got this thing called a ring modulator here. I can hear my voice coming through it now.
So this is a rather elderly-looking microphone attached to... what are those things below your feet there?
I can't possibly tell you, but they're very dangerous. That's a ring modulator, and that's a mixer. I've just got the mixer here because, as Brian will probably tell you, the secret of a good Dalek voice is to really overload the mic signal to make it not quite distorted, but quite fluffy. You know, and then you send that through the ring modulator, and you can hear it just blurring out my voice now like that. And then you get the full effect like that. You will be exterminated! Thank you. You would all make good Daleks.
The voice has changed over the years then, did they?
It has changed a bit. I remember talking to Dick Mills, who did lots of sound design for Doctor Who with you, Brian, and asking him why, in my anoraki way, I said, why does the Dalek voice change? And Dick sort of made a brave fist of explaining this, and he went, oh, we just forgot to write down the setting. You know? So we just made it up every time.
I'm sorry, that's one of Dick's stories.
Brian, what do you remember about how you formulated how these creatures should sound, how their personalities were reflected in this voice?
Well... you depend very much on the actor. If you can't get the actor to do the performance, then it won't work properly. So I was very lucky. I was working with another genius, Peter Hawkins. And the original treatment of the voice with the ring modulator was for a different robot, rather polite robot, on a children's radio program called Sword from the Stars. And that was a much more gentle butler-type robot. So that when it had to become a nasty robot, we tweaked the modulation. And the modulation is actually should be, the original Dalek modulation is 30 cycles, which we reckoned that was about the most intelligible. And at one point, I think there was a boss Dalek And we modulated him as a combination of 100 and 30 cycles together, just to differentiate the boss and the serfs, so to speak.
So, Tim, is the Dalek voice something that's sort of made in the microphone, as it were, made with that gizmo that Nick has under his feet? Or these days, do you take it and do something else to it as well?
Well, sometimes we take Nick's device straight from location, because often it's very good. We also take a clean feed of Nick's mic. So we've always got Nick clean on I was going to say tape, but it's not tape, in the box. So we've got Nick's voice, and then we've got our own box. We got another ring modulator in bass, so we can also use that to recreate that. But I think really the secret of the Dalek voice is not so much the gizmo, but the acting. It's all in the acting.
And well, the ghosts obviously of previous actors who have played the Daleks survive in your performance, don't they, Nick?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a homage to, Peter Hawkins. And I kind of try to get the various different old Dalek voices in there. I put their names on my script. You know, there's a Peter and a Roy and a David.
Can you give us a demo, the difference between these?
Oh, well, the
Peter Hawkins one is the... my favourite one, who talks like this. But then you have the Roy Skelton one. He used to play Zippy on Rainbow. So there is that kind of tone to his voice.
The David Graham one, I can't really... He had this way of talking that was very disturbing.
Yeah. Brilliant, though. They were, they're an inspiration. It's that business about overloading the mic signal into the ring modulator. It's really difficult to get a sound engineer to do that. They want, and there have been a couple of occasions on the new series where I haven't felt the voice sounded quite right because they just wouldn't overload it enough. So I bring my own mixer along now and I provide them with the overloaded signal. They can't do anything about it.
Okay, well, I think it's time now for a bit of a masterclass in one of the new Doctor Who monster voices. Paul and Tim, for a recent episode called Cold War, you had to revive a monster from Brian's era of the programme, the Ice Warriors of Mars. We're going to hear now how they sounded in 1967.
Supposing someone sees you...
So, Tim, that was the original Varga the Ice Warrior, played by Bernard Brestel from the Carry On film.
That's the 1967 version. They don't make him like that anymore.
So what did you do to this?
Well, we wanted it to be, true to the character from 1967. So we obviously, had to listen to that, trying to work out what they'd done, although Brian's now told us, so we could have saved us a lot of time. So we'd asked him. So if we play... I think that 1967 click, a lot of it's in the acting with the s in the voice, it was all shh, which obviously Nick did. So if we can play Nick's, this is Nick completely clean, so if we can play Nick completely clean voice.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit.
So we've got a bit of Nick there. That's completely clean, Nick in front of a microphone, just acting. So we took that and then we dropped the pitch of it so we can hear Nick drop down in pitch.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit.
So we had those two together and then we needed something on top of it to make it. I didn't think there was enough threat in it, so I thought it needed a bit more something. So we came up with this effects track which we're going to hear now. So that's the sound of a beluga whale messed about with a bit. Well, I must say, no whales were harmed in the making of this show. So we added the two nicks, a few more breaths, and the clicks, and we put them together, and now we'll hear the finished Skaldak.
You attacked me. Martian law decrees that the people of this planet are forfeit. I now have all the information I require. It will take only one missile to begin the process to end this Cold War.
There we go, new Skaldak.
Wow, brilliant. And was it important, because this is a living, breathing creature, yeah, rather than something robotic, that underneath this there should be the sound of an animal, something organic?
Yes, yeah, so you need to keep the, you know, the need to hear the dialogue, so you can't go too far with it. So I think those clicks just do the, they just set you
it's
in another
really
world,
nice
and it's
touch.
Spooky.
I love that, yeah.
And also, you know, when he's not doing anything, he can still click away, so you know he's there in the background. You go, oh, this is a bit dodgy.
Yeah. Before we go, I want to ask you one last thing. I wonder what you think about what part that sound has played in the longevity of Doctor Who. How have these atmospheres associated with the series helped to place it in the landscape of the culture, Nick?
Oh, well, I can only speak personally, and, you know, they inhabit my brain, you know. Your sounds are haunting. You know what, in those old days, we didn't have video recorders, so I would tape record Doctor Who to remember it. So for me, Doctor Who is very much a sound thing, which is why I've gone on to work on Doctor Who on sound. And your sounds, Brian, were just amazing.
Paul, what part does it play?
Well, I mean, you're also in awe of what's gone before, but it's 50 years. You know, I was born when it started, but I always try and get something out of the archive and slip it in whenever I can, just to create that special feel. And so it's never far away, and I hope you appreciate that.
Tim?
Well, I think there's two things in Doctor Who that really work. One is it's the start of the theme tune, which is that scream, which Russell always called the call from the kitchen. So even if you've forgotten it's on, you hear that, you go, Doctor Who's on, you have to dash into the sitting room and watch it. And the other one is the sound of Brian's TARDIS, because it's such an iconic sound. And, you know, if anybody in Britain these days, any show on television, if they want to demonstrate time travel, it's always the sound of the TARDIS, and it's never been bettered.
Brian, what role has it played? How much does Doctor Who owe to the strange sounds that we hear when we watch it?
I think in the beginning it was very difficult to get sets that didn't wobble and doors that would open properly on cue. And the sound just gave it another element, so that you weren't constantly sort of troubled by all the strange other things that were going on. It gave it sort of homogeneity and created a new world.
And that's where we have to press the fast return switch, I'm afraid, and get back to the end of the interval on Saturday night. But before we enter the vortex, there's just time to thank our guests. Tim Ricketts, Paul Jeffries, Nick Briggs and Brian Hodgson. Set the controls for the Albert Hall. We're off again.
Matthew Sweet, our very own Radio 3 time traveller, arriving back from the Royal College of Music, where he was before or possibly during or maybe even after this Doctor Who prom, live from the Royal Albert Hall. Incidentally, it's trending on Twitter. Tweets from all over the universe, at least the US, Chile, Spain, France, and including some younger listeners enjoying their first ever prom live on BBC Radio 3. Well, I'm Louise Fryer. I'm surrounded by Fez-wearing fans. Sean Lay is with me. Sean, not wearing a fez, I notice.
I rather think I've missed out on this, haven't I? I don't know who makes fezes at the moment, but they must be doing good business thanks to Matt Smith's endorsement of the fez as the Doctor, and of course the bow ties, a few of those on display as well. Although I suppose less untypical in the Albert Hall.
I guess so. We have quite a few bow ties on stage amongst the National Orchestra of Wales, at least. Now, talking about the more recent incarnations of Doctor Who, how has the music changed? We were hearing there about the original sound world and how it was created. What's new?
Less electronic music. I mean, we've got a couple of old synthesizers up on the stage, which will be used in the second half. I don't want to give too much away. But they were a very important part of the Doctor Who. I grew up in the 70s. A composer like a man called Dudley Simpson, a 90-year-old Australian who composed something like 300 episodes of Doctor Who music over the years between the 60s and 1980. And he's still with us, I'm delighted to say. He relied very much on that to help enhance the ordinary typical instruments that he was able to use. He would have killed to have the orchestra that Murray has his hands on, the National Orchestra of Wales. He might have used just a handful of musicians. And then going further back in the 60s, a lot of composers would have been asked to provide very short bits of music with only two or three musicians. In the early days, played in virtually as live into the studio recording. Some big names back then. Richard Rodney Bennett was one of the first composers on Doctor Who. The jazz musician Don Harper. Stanley Myers, who's still composing today for cinema, had much fun with Le Marseillaise for a story set in the French Revolution. And Jeffrey Bergen, the late Jeffrey Bergen, a few years before he did Brideshead Revisited, did a couple of very memorable suites of music for Doctor Who in the mid-1970s. So there's a big range of styles, and that in a sense reflects the programme, because of course it really is a programme without a format. It can be set anywhere in the past or future or the present, on an alien planet or here on Earth. It's really only limited by the imagination, and the imagination of the composers is as important as that of the writers or the directors.
It really deals with some pretty heavy subjects, doesn't it? I mean, we've been being privileged, if you like, to watch clips on the big screens, and more are coming up. And that applause is for the conductor, Ben Foster, stepping on to the stage for part two of this Doctor Who from All Strange, Strange Creatures coming up. He's illuminated his sonic baton, and off we go. strange, strange creatures, and plenty of them in evidence here at the Royal Albert Hall, including the Jadoon and an ice warrior in the centre of the arena. And coming onto the platform, the 11th Doctor.
Hello. Are we having a nice time? I can't hear you. I said, are we having a nice time? Yay! Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to the second half of this Doctor Who prom. That was all the strange, strange creatures performed by the Doctor Who House Band, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, the London Philharmonic Choir, and all under the sonic baton of our resident maestro, Mr. Ben Foster, ladies and gentlemen. Now, in case you're wondering, my name is Matt Smith and I play the Doctor, and as you all know, this is a very special year for Doctor Who. 50 years! Amazing, it's amazing. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate than to be here with all of you. One of the great joys of playing this extraordinary, legendary Time Lord is the support and knowledge and love and brilliance of you guys, the fans. You really make the show what it is, so thank you from the bottom of my heart. You are the best. But now it is time for more of Murray Gold's brilliant music. The next piece made its debut last year in Asylum of the Daleks, together with a rather enigmatic new character. It's as delicate as a souffle, and one of my personal favourites. Here is The Impossible Girl.
the Doctor's companion, Clara, featured in the video clips during The Impossible Girl, and here she comes in real life.
My name is Jenna Coleman, and I play Clara Oswald in Doctor Who. We have just been listening to Murray Gold's theme that's been Clara's, sometimes Oswin's, always the Impossible Girl's musical companion on her travels through time and space with the Doctor. Next, we're going to hear a piece of music that featured in an episode of Doctor Who first broadcast in the late 70s. The Robots of Death starred Tom Baker as the Doctor and features a soundtrack by Doctor Who's most prolific composer, Dudley Simpson. Dudley's soundtrack included an arrangement of a beautiful piano piece by French composer Claude Debussy, and we're now going to hear Ben Foster's brand new take of that same piece. Here is The Girl with the Flaxen Hair.
Cheveux de Lin, Debussy, taking us back over 100 years. Not quite so far back, Peter Davison was the fifth Doctor.
Hello, everyone.
Wow, what amazing memories you all have. Even though most of you weren't even born. My name is Peter Davison. This is fun! Now we've been introduced, you can call me 005, if you like. I've no idea how many doctors there will be, but now we can go up to 999. I'm so pleased to be with you today for this special celebration of 50 years of Doctor Who, and I'm especially excited to be introducing this next sequence that looks back to the classic era, my era of Doctor Who, now called the... thank you. Now called the Classic Series. That's a bit like the Championship is to the Premier League. the classic series of Doctor Who ran for 26 years from 1963. Obviously, I'm quite late on in those 26 years. Not 1963, I'm not that old. Actually, I'm almost that old. This sequence includes music by Tristram Carey, Martin Slavin, Malcolm Clark, Dudley Simpson, Paddy Kingsland, Peter Howell, and Mark Ayres. And it begins with the iconic sound of the TARDIS created by Brian Hodgson with the help of his mother's front door key and a piano string. Please don't try this at home. And then made more weird and more wonderful in the now legendary BBC Radiophonic Workshop. To perform this classic Doctor Who medley, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales is joined by two of these composers, Mark Ayres and Peter Howell. Please give them a huge classic round of applause.
They're standing by their tape banks and synthesizers, all ready to go.
Philosophically or geographically? And we're going to lunch. I know a little place that has a wonderful bouillabaisse.
Do you like bouillabaisse?
Bouillabaisse, yum yum.
The end. But the moment has been prepared for.
He was the doctor all the time.
Throughout the universe, I have battled against evil, against power mad conspirators. I should stay here. Daleks from Taran's Cybermen. They're still in the nursery compared to us. 10 million years of absolute power. That's what it takes to be really corrupt.
What's happened?
Change, my dear. And it seems not a moment too soon.
She's my mum, and I don't love her. What's wrong with me? Why can't I stop hating her?
You love the baby.
But I didn't know she was my mum!
Love and hate. Frightening feeling. Especially when the trap struggling beneath the surface.
We'll be right back.
classic Doctor Who medley, accompanied by footage from early episodes, starting in black and white, moving on into colour. Bastra and Strax.
I've just been informed that we're about to hear two very special pieces, which I find hard to believe. They have been written by human children.
Strax, I think you might be in for a surprise. In the run-up to the Doctor Who prom, your British Broadcasting Corporation has been running a competition for school children. The challenge was to work in teams to write music to go with scenes from last year's Christmas special, The Snowmen.
It seems that hundreds of entries were received, and now we're going to hear the two winning pieces. First, we want to introduce you to the winning composers. In the 11 to 14 junior category, they are William Davenport and Jordan Picken from Stoke-on-Trent. Stand up.
And now, the winners in the 14 to 16 senior category, Gabe Stone and Matthew Owen from Cirencester.
Stand up. Prepare yourselves, humans. First, you'll hear the winning entry in the senior category. This will be followed by the junior category winner. I'm off to prepare my Sontaran battle song. Ha!
Come on, quickly! What are you doing?
My bustle is stuck.
Your bustle? You're going to have to take those clothes off.
I didn't mean...
I know.
I just...
I understand, I do.
Good.
Now, what's the plan?
Who said I've got a plan?
Of course you've got a plan. You took that.
Maybe I'm an idiot.
You're not. You're clever, really clever.
Are you? If I've got a plan, what is it? You tell me.
That's the way to do it.
Is this a test?
Yes.
What will it do to us?
Kill her.
That's the way to do it.
So come on, then plan. Do I have one?
Oh, I know what your plan is. I knew straight away.
No.
Of course I did.
Show me.
Why should I?
Because we'll be dead in under 30 seconds. Do I have a plan?
If we'd been escaping, we'd be climbing down the building. If we'd been hiding, we'd be on the other side of the roof. But no, we're standing right here.
So?
So? After you.
After you?
After you. I'm wearing a dress. Eyes front, soldier.
My eyes are always front.
Mine aren't.
Stop it.
No. I understand you're the previous governess. Are you going to inform me the position is taken? Good night. So you can move your cloud, you can control it.
No, no one can control clouds. That would be silly. The wind, a little bit.
She's following us.
That's the idea. Keep her away from the snow. So, barmaid or governess, which is it?
That thing is after us and you want to chat?
Well, we can't chat off. We've been horribly killed, can we?
How do we get up so high so quick?
Clever staircase. Taller on the inside.
What am I standing on? What's this made of?
Super dense water vapour. Should keep her trapped for the moment.
That was the senior category winners, Gabe Stone and Matthew Owen's soundtrack. Now for the juniors.
I never know why. I only know who.
Who's this?
Me. Giving in.
I don't know why I'm crying.
I do. Remember this. Remember this right now, all of it, because this is the day. This is the day.
This is the day! Everything begins! Clara! Clara!
Get off of me!
Water vapor doesn't stop ice, I should have realized.
Get off!
Let her go! Let her go now! Now!
Get off of me!
No!
music by the junior winners William Davenport and Jordan Picken. Now watch out, here come the arch enemies of the Doctor, the Daleks, and they're pretty grumpy with conductor Ben Foster.
Attention humans, this Royal Albert Hall is now under Dalek control. The building is surrounded. There is no escape from the Daleks. You must obey or be exterminated. Exterminate, exterminate, exterminate.
Ben's trying to push them away.
What is that device you are holding? What is that strange noise? Explain yourself! Keep away from me! No! Ah! Alert! Alert! The conductor is overacting! Alert! Alert! The Daleks are allergic to overacting!
Ben tried kicking one. To no effect. He's gone back.
This celebration of the Predator is offensive to the Daleks and must be cleansed. Orchestra, you are now all slaves of the Daleks. You will play special Dalek music. You will obey. Conductor, remain on that platform and stop overacting. Resist us and you will be exterminated. Behold the might of the Dalek Empire. Humans, will you obey the Daleks forever?
No!
Answer correctly. Let me hear you say exterminate.
Exterminate.
I cannot hear you. Very good, Daleks. In that case, Ben Foster, before you receive your BAFTA, if you value your life, you will begin or be exterminated.
Ben obliges. The Daleks keep guard.
Thank you.
The Royal Albert Hall stage under Dalek occupation, and the Prommers keeping very quiet for a few moments there. The Daleks now making their way off. Well, luckily there's a ramp and no stairs, so the Daleks can glide away easily enough. Now, applause for another early companion.
Doctor's first screen companion, his granddaughter, Susan Foreman. We've just heard first there were Daleks. Fantastic. Now, I first met the Doctor's oldest and most despised enemy nearly 50 years ago with the great William Hartnell. In a story that is known today simply as The Daleks. As actors, our first experience of meeting them in rehearsal was far from terrifying. Only half a Dalek, with small actors inside, propelling them with their feet. We were asked to please not use them as dodging cars, as the budget didn't stretch to new ones. But we quickly realized how big an impact they were making when children no longer played cops and robbers, or cowboys and Indians, but Daleks. Exterminate! One of the great things about being an actor in a show like this is that you get to be a kid again and really believe. Although we often got the giggles when we were introduced to some of the new monsters. We all took it very seriously, though, and waited with great, great excitement for the next script. And who'd have thought that this celebration would be happening 50 years on? It is amazing, isn't it? It is amazing. Amazing. Well, this next piece brought the most recent series to a close and left us with one of Doctor Who's greatest cliffhangers. Well, I don't know about you, but I can't wait till November, and Matt won't tell me a thing. Anyway, for now, here is The Name of the Doctor.
Thank you. information. Valuable information.
Are you bargaining for your life?
The doctor. The doctor has a secret, you know. He has one he will take to the grave. And it is discovered.
Run, you clever boy. And remember me.
on the screens around the Royal Albert Hall. Tense moments from the most recent series and a very brief appearance introducing the new Doctor, John Hurt. Over to Matt Smith.
So, what does it all mean, eh? Only another 4 months till we find out.
All right. Stop teasing.
I know, that's my job. So, that was music from The Name of the Doctor, Stephen Moffat's enigmatic and brilliant finale to Series 7. I'm sure I remember him saying no more cliffhangers.
Yeah. Sadly, time is racing and we're fast approaching the end of the 50th anniversary celebration of Doctor Who, but before we say goodbye, another first. To mark this special occasion, Murray Gold has written a brand new piece that he describes as a love song to a television series.
To perform the world premiere of Song for 50, please welcome back our soloists, Ellie Manahan-Thomas and Alan Clayton, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and the London Philharmonic Choir, and Mr. Ben Foster!
Happy birthday to who? To Doctor Who. That was the world premiere of Song for 50, composed by Murray Gold, with soloists Ellen Manahan Thomas and Alan Clayton, Ben Foster conducting the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and the London Philharmonic Choir. And the 11th Doctor is back.
Well done, that marvellous. What a wonderful, wonderful performance. That was Song for 50, written by Doctor Who's very own maestro, Mr. Murray Gold. And please, let's hear it for our fantastic soloists, Ellie Manahan Thomas and Alan Clayton. Marvellous stuff. Now, would you like to hear some more? They would like to hear some more. Well, you're in for a treat. To end this very special Doctor Who prom, we're going to take you back in time, to the 23rd of November 1963, when the very first episode of Doctor Who was broadcast on BBC television. It introduced to the world one of the most iconic theme tunes ever written in the history of the universe.
Composed by Ron Grainer and arranged by Delia Derbyshire in BBC's legendary radiophonic workshop, it was unlike anything anyone had heard before. We'll end the concert with Murray Gold's latest version of the greatest theme tune of all time.
But first, something extra special. Valet d'Etchem was first heard in January 2010 in The End of Time, originally written for the 10th Doctor's regeneration. With this performance, we're going to pay tribute to all the Doctors. Enjoy.
Ballet d'Etchem, the audience cheering the on-screen appearance of each Doctor in turn. And now, prepare yourselves for that iconic signature tune that I think probably made the series. Sonic baton at the ready. The famous Doctor Who signature tune in its most recent incarnation by Murray Gold. And he's giving a warm hug to the conductor, Ben Foster. It ends this Doctor Who prom 50 years since the series first aired. All the aliens grouping around the stage during the closing moments of the screens showed a montage of opening title sequences from 1963 to the present day. The BBC National Orchestra of Wales, leader Leslie Hatfield, members of the Radiophonic Workshop, the London Philharmonic Choir, and soloists Ellen Manahan-Thomas and former Radio 3 New Generation artist Alan Clayton, all taking their bows. Together with the 11th Doctor, Matt Smith, Clara, Jenna Coleman, Madame Vastra, Neve McIntosh, Strax, his butler's tailcoat, not out of place at a prom, Dan Starkey, and the 5th Doctor, Peter Davison, and the first ever companion, Carol Ann Ford. Well, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales are back for their first prom with their new chief conductor, Thomas Sondergor, on Thursday, the 18th of July. That's Shin-Mishnovsky's Third Symphony and Strauss's Alpine Symphony on the programme, beginning at 7. Meanwhile, tomorrow, François Xavier Roth brings his own orchestra, Les Siècles, in a programme of riot and revolutionary music from the 18th century to the 20th, from Lully and Gramo to Stravinsky's Rite of Spring. That's at 7:30, live, of course, here on Radio 3. But I think the cheers and the drumming of feet is going to carry on all night here at the Royal Albert Hall. We have to hand back to Broadcasting House.
Louise, thank you very much. There was Louise Fryer there at the Royal Albert Hall. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a little after 3 minutes past 10. A move to a smaller home can lead to some painful decisions about what possessions to keep and what to sell or pass on. Well, tonight in Between the Ears, we've another chance to hear a programme which follows three people over a number of months as they wrestle with that difficult dilemma.
Frozen deep. The Sea House. Mansfield Park by Jane Austen.
I remember sitting in my sitting room, looking around and saying, I can't. I can't. I simply can't do it.
Glenn David Gold, Sunnyside.
This is my life. I can't just throw it away.
Martin Amis, Experience.
I knew I could keep about 300 books.
The Voices of Morbath by Eamon Duffy.
And so I had to make this choice. I had to go through them all, thinking I'll keep that and I won't keep that. And it was just impossible.
If Nobody Speaks of Remarkable Things by John McGregor.
I was frightened.
The King of Inventors by Catherine Peters.
I had 3 days when I had to go to hospital. I felt so awful. That getting rid thing is very painful.
To do with recordings. What's this? I don't know where to begin, actually. I mean, that's only what we've got 4 boxes of these. They're all part of my career because I still get bookings, even though I don't want them. It's been a bit lonely. It's very, very quiet, as you can sense. It's quite soundproof. And you feel cut off, really, but you can see things happening outside. I'm getting older, and nothing's working. Not the fault of the flat. It's just life, I guess. It's got more technical. And at Denver Hall, they have a handyman. So that's lovely. Somebody there. There's a programme. Some will be classical and some will be light. That was a painting in Devon. That's a Spark Whitby. I was singing with the orchestra there. And let's have a look at what the programme was. I sang A Song in the Night by Raymond Loughborough. Romance from the Desert Song, Sempre Libre from La Traviata, and a selection from Summer Song. I remember my father and mother were there, and my father was very nervous, and he couldn't sleep after the concert. He was too excited, and he was worried about one note I sang. And so I said, oh, Daddy, don't worry about it, it's gone now. Dear Miss Farley, it's written by a gentleman called Mr. Cronk. I felt that I must write to say once again how much my wife and I enjoyed your beautiful singing on Friday last, a sentiment that was also expressed by all present. Your performance contributed in no small measure to a very successful and enjoyable evening, and I sincerely trust that we shall have the pleasure of hearing you again in the not-too-distant future. That's a very nice letter. The 8th of May, 1972. Idea of just throwing it away. I don't want to. Can you understand the feeling? Because it's my life and I don't want to throw it away.
plan for today is to go through the garage to try and establish what they want to keep, what we can throw away, and what the boys, their two sons, would like to hold on to. And our challenge in today is that Mike will want to keep everything and Sue won't particularly, but obviously we're trying to make sure that we don't take the soul out of Mike by checking all his stuff away that he won't be able to use anymore.
Yep, and I think we're going to have Mike come and sit out with us today just so that he does feel involved.
Is there a chair out here?
I can bring one out.
Yeah, can get some.
Yeah, I'll get a garden chair, shall I? Or do you want to...
Whatever's best for Mike to sit on and Sue.
Yeah, he's okay.
Okay. Right, keep there your leggings in, Mike. Okay.
There we go.
That's
for his trolley.
Electric buggy.
For the golf clubs.
And that battery's been on charge since I had my stroke. You see, it's charged up by now. The end of last May, it was a year ago. 27th of May, I was delivering four boxes of a church magazine called The Belfry. And I was just leaning into the back of my van to take him up the church, and all of a sudden my feet went. I just collapsed in the back of the van.
And I didn't realise that it was anything really bad until I got to the hospital, and the ambulance man, he hugged me and he said he's had a stroke. And it was a big one.
So my face, this side of my face, it still tingles. And my right leg muscle is not working properly. Maybe walk like Quasimodo.
Do you know, I haven't seen this stuff.
No.
This is a new wheelie.
That's that's my new electric trolley that broke.
It broke, so that can be thrown then. Right,
leave it.
No, it's broken.
No, it's not that. That's not broken.
So is it usable?
Yes.
Well, you've already got one there, haven't you?
No. God dear.
So you got an electric trolley. You've got another electric trolley.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Do you need to?
Well, yeah, that's a new one.
So, should we throw the old one out?
No.
No, okay.
These are old tapes, aren't they?
Fleetwood Mac.
Got them
here. Nat King Cole.
The hits of 1961.
That's when I started work.
So
what, 1961?
Yeah.
It was a good year, Mike.
Unforgettable. That's what you are.
Oh, well, I was trained as a compositor and then as a typesetter. Typesetting books, all that used to bore me stiff, that did. Oh, I shall be playing golf again, whatever happens. I might even play squash again. How the father viewed us.
Left Madrid in thick white mist, miserable, cold, things looming spookily. Mist cleared much later, pretty country, windmills in La Mancha.
I want to remember these
trips and reread them again, because you read something and you think, oh yes, I remember that funny old man we met in the cafe, or something, you know, something slipped out of your mind long ago, but reading it again, you just relive it all. It's so lovely. I must keep this desk. I know it's much too big, really, to be sensible, but I love it. Cost me all of £10. Lovely drive to Cordoba, where we arrived about 3-ish and drove out to Castilla de... Can't read my own writing, sorry.